Hello and welcome to this episode of This Is My Son. I'm your host, Kathy Fisher, and with me today I have a famous individual from online.
Yep.
A artist. Do you consider yourself an artist?
Yeah, I guess so.
Let's say artist and computer boy.
Computer boy, online.
A net boy.
Net online boy.
Okay. It is, of course, your pal, Chris Jock. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Now, Chris, you were excited to be on the podcast.
Oh, I was super pumped.
Rightly so, because it's one of the best.
This is one of the most great podcasts that have ever been.
Ever. And there's only been 2 episodes so far.
Yeah.
But you could already identify it.
It's already the best.
It's great to know that I'm rocketing to the top of the charts.
You're the most popular podcast on iTunes right now. Yeah,
exactly. I got a letter from Apple the other day informing me you're number one. And I said, yep.
You just said, yeah, of course.
Obviously.
Like, clearly.
So I think maybe we should start this podcast with the background of you recommending things to me or giving media to me. Because it informs the choices that have been made.
Oh yeah, I have a history.
I would describe it in, to sum it up, your history is giving me sad dog stories.
Yeah, I like to make you cry.
Uh-huh.
That's one of my goals. So, historically, I find the media that made me cry the most, and I try to make you look at it.
So is there any, other than wanting to share that emotion, is there any reason why this has been happening to me?
In part, it's because you're one of the only people I can get to actually, like, read or watch the things that I recommend based on their sadness levels.
Mm-hmm.
And also, like, you like dogs, so I know that they'll make you cry.
I can confirm that. I do like dogs, and I often will cry at sad dog stories, so.
Good.
I can see that. All right, so we've summed that up. Would you like to introduce the son that you presented to me for this week's episode?
Yes. The son that I selected was The Plague Dogs, the Martin Rosen animated feature from sometime in the 70s. I don't remember
80s,
the year.
Actually.
Really?
83, yeah, early 80s.
And it's based on a Richard Adams novel about 2 dogs who escape from a research laboratory. And the book is a lot more upbeat than the movie. just for the record. Like, the book ending has hope.
The movie ending does not. I was checking up on the Wikipedia page for both the book and the movie before this.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, that would have been a lot more cheerful if the book ending had happened in the movie. So, yeah, I guess we should maybe start digging into that. Because it's definitely one of the things that I noted about this versus a lot of sad dog stories is that there's almost no positive emotion in this movie at all.
Very little. There are brief glimmers of hope that are snuffed out.
Immediately. It's like,
as soon as possible. Like, they don't want to keep you going. Like, they don't want to give you any false expectations about what's happening in this movie.
Yeah, you pretty much know, like, beginning to end, it's going to end badly for everyone. There's no happiness in the world.
Well, I mean, this is a movie I would charitably describe as bleak.
Yeah, it's like whatever bleak times 5 is.
Yeah, like, I think bleak is one of the more gentle descriptions of this movie.
So to sort of outline for the viewer who likely has not seen it, because I don't think it's that popularly seen of a movie.
I mean, it's not, like, I don't think there's a Blu-ray release. There was a DVD, like a very bare-bones DVD, which is the one that I have.
Yeah, it came out on Amazon Prime, actually.
Really?
So yeah, you can stream it if you've got Amazon Prime.
Okay, well, that's a recommendation for our listeners who want to feel sad.
Hot tip, if you like to feel sad, and you got Amazon Prime,
we have something for you.
Oh boy, will you be excited about this? Yeah, so I mean, these two dogs who have been, you know, horribly abused in a lab escape. Which
is shown on screen to some extent.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, at least for Ralph, who's the black lab dog. Yeah, it's very painfully horrible abuse. They escape, and you think, hey, maybe them escaping, they'll go on like a fun adventure, they'll be enjoying their freedom.
Oh, they'll find a new master, and they'll live happily.
A kind human to take care of them and love them, maybe. Well, you might think that, and you will be wrong. Because instead, they are forced to try to figure out how to live off the land in this, you know, like bleak, like Scottish moor, basically.
Yeah, it's like Northern England.
Yeah, it's and so yeah, they get into some trouble because they kill some sheep so they don't starve to death. They make friends with a fox,
And then, they eat a human.
Yeah, so I read about that. Apparently, it was cut out of the cut of the movie that I saw. But in some cuts, it's more graphically shown.
It's not really graphic. You just see the dogs approaching the corpse, and you just know, like, what else is a dog gonna do with a dead guy? Like,
yeah, I mean, I kind of assumed it when I was watching it that, like, well, they're hungry and starving. They probably will eat it. They'd sort of then just cut to the next scene. But apparently, in the original theatrical cut that's like was only released in Australia or something, they have a shot of the mutilated corpse from above. Which, you know, more concretely states, like, yeah, they ate this dude that they killed kind of accidentally.
Yeah, they accidentally kill a couple of people.
They accidentally shoot a guy in the face.
That is the nightmare scene in that movie, because it's like, oh, they found a nice human. Yay. Oh, no.
Oh, he's no. Super dead. Yeah. The thing is, too, I'll say this also, one of the other major first impressions I had of it is that it's beautifully animated.
Oh, yeah. It's very by the same team that did Watership Down. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
I actually haven't.
That was actually on my short list of, like, I have three disturbing animal movies that I always try to get people to watch.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like Watership Down is the mildest one, and it's the easiest one to actually get people to watch.
This one, I would imagine, is a little bit more of a struggle.
Oh, yeah. Plague Dogs has a reputation.
Yeah. I mean, I knew basically nothing about it coming into it other than, like, reading the synopsis.
Yeah.
On, like, IMDb. Yeah, I was not prepared for what actually happened to me.
Oh, I mean, I'm not really sorry.
Yeah, I know you delight in this. So,
I do. And did I tell you, like, in college, I made Max watch this with me more than once.
Oh, no.
Like,
more than once?
Yeah, I like, bought the DVD at a store, and, like, we watched it. And then later I made him watch it again.
You know, I think that just demonstrates the power of friendship involved there, that he was willing to watch it a second time.
Oh yeah, I made him watch a lot of movies of, I don't know, it's not really, I guess, like, questionable emotional effect on humans.
Well, so there is a certain value, and I would say, to me, definitely interesting to show movies that you know are really emotionally affecting to people that you're friends with and sort of see how they respond to it.
Yeah.
Because I think it's a good way to gauge what type of person someone is.
Oh, yeah. Right? If you watch Plague Dogs and your face isn't, like, covered in snot and tears and permanently fixed in an expression of
horror
once you're done, then I would be worried that you're, like, a sociopath or something.
Total pain and desolation.
Yeah.
So I'll say one thing that, so compared to, so the first sad dog story you gave me was the graphic novel Laika, which, if you know, our users, if our listeners are not aware, is about the dog that the Soviets sent into space to die in a space capsule.
Yeah, this was the only book I've ever read that I couldn't finish because I was literally blinded by tears.
Yeah.
So like I decided to give it to you as a gift.
Our old friend Adrian Choi once likened it to giving someone a gift of a dead puppy in a box for Christmas. And I'll say, yeah, I totally also, like, the ending of Laika reliably can make turn me into like a snotty sobbing mess.
Yep.
But I will say that Plague Dogs, in comparison, I don't think it elicited tears as powerfully.
No.
Because I think I'd been numbed to how the awful bleakness of it throughout it. Like, it didn't have, since it didn't have any of the emotional highs or the joys.
Or they were very brief.
Or they were so brief, so fleeting that you knew it was going to end soon.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to, I mean, the premise of Laika is that, you know, she has an owner who loves her, mm-hmm. but despite that, is forced to send her off to die, basically die horribly.
Yeah.
So to me, that to have that contrast and that high and low is a lot more powerful emotionally than something that's just depressing all the way through.
Yeah, and Plague Dogs is definitely more, like, less tears and more just, like, feelings of hopelessness. Like, it's just despair. Like, it's despair, the movie.
I agree. Yeah, and I mean, even the ending, which is, I think, deliberately made a little ambiguous and compared to the book, which is apparently has a more upbeat ending, which, mm-hmm. I don't know, it doesn't, from what I read, at least on the Wikipedia page, doesn't seem like it would have been believable in the movie.
No, like, not with the, like, level of despair that they had been going through. Like, it would seem like a Deus Ex Machina.
Yeah. But even so, I don't know, yeah, so it's meant to be ambiguous. You know, at the end, they're kind of, like, swimming off into the horizon, into the ocean, mm-hmm. Thinking maybe there's an island that they're going to arrive at. And it's sort of implied that the last shot is of an island, but it's not clear if it's, like, heaven, if it's dog heaven, or there actually was an island that they got to.
I think it's heavily implied that they die.
Yeah, but to me, that's the worst thing, right? It's because Ralph specifically escapes the medical lab or the research lab,
mm-hmm.
because he had been forced to do these experiments where he's basically put into a tank of water to see how long he would keep trying to swim before he got exhausted and sank to the bottom. Then they resuscitated him and made him do it again. So it's like, mm-hmm. hellish, the most torturous thing. And then the movie is consigning them to that death, essentially, which is already described and shown in the beginning part of the movie as being, like, the most horrific thing.
Oh, yeah.
So to me, that's really what sticks with me as being, like, the most bleak and despairing element of it, is even if there is kind of the ambiguous, like, oh, well, they're happy after they died, like, they left all the horrible pain and suffering of the physical world behind, it's still, they still had to die that way, which is, you know, just horrific.
And I think that actually plays really well in the movie. Like, the fact that Ralph has been tortured with drowning, and he, you know, he's kind of the leader at the end who's like, I see an island, we're going to keep swimming.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's that nobility and dignity that's just like, it's like he's trying to keep up hope because what else does he have? And he's willing, excuse me, he's willing to die that way rather than just stay on shore scared and be shot.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, so it's something about hope. I guess the message is about hope.
Well, it's like, hope is pointless, but it's still better than nothing.
hope is better than total despair. So, therefore, we should keep sticking to it, I guess.
I mean, I wouldn't even see it as really immoral. It's just, like, this is a hopeless situation, and, like, Ralph has just, like, Ralph's personality changes over the course of the movie. Like, he actually has an arc, and his arc is in becoming more, I don't know, hopeful, or, like, yeah, trying to find something in life besides just, like, being sad and hating humans.
Yeah, I will say that I agree. It is nice to see an arc. Yeah, well, I'd say, okay, so all of the characters, all of the dog characters, dog/fox characters have arcs,
mm-hmm.
in the movie. So Snitter, who's the other dog that he escapes with, had like a brain, some sort of brain surgery that like messes with his perception of reality.
Mm-hmm.
And he sort of, I guess, gradually slips into more of a sort of delusional state as the movie progresses.
Yeah. Yeah, he's in kind of a constant state of fantasy, or can't tell the difference between fantasy and reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also then has this perception, and sort of reinforced by the movie, that every human he comes into contact with, including his owner, dies.
Yep.
And he's also one that shoots the human in the face. You yeah. may ask, how does a dog shoot a human in the face? And then it'll be revealed when you see the movie.
Yeah, you'll find out. Now you have to watch it.
Dogs can use guns. It's true. It's a fact.
Known fact about dogs.
Yeah. So he's sort of at the beginning the more hopeful one, and I think at the end Ralph has to like become more hopeful to compensate for the fact that he's sort of losing that that innocence and hope for the future.
Yep.
Even I'm just thinking about it, it's just making me sad again, Chris.
I mean, that's what this movie does. That's what it's for.
Like, can we just... So, okay. There's... The genre of sad dog movies is, you know, wide-ranging.
Yep.
There are a lot of examples out there. I mean, some... But there's definitely... I don't know. So you've got, say, like, Old Yeller.
Mm-hmm.
You've got, I don't know, Shiloh. You got Marley and Me. I'm trying to think of what are, like, the key...
Homeward Bound, maybe, like, My Dog Skip a little bit. Like, it has...
Oh, Milo and Otis. How about that?
Oh, I haven't seen Milo and Otis in a long time, but the reason I'm sad about that is because real animals got abused.
That's true. That's not good. But I did watch it a lot as a kid, and it is very scarring.
Yeah. Yeah.
You shouldn't throw dogs over waterfalls. Let's put it out there.
I mean, they killed several dogs by throwing them over waterfalls.
This is just, we're going to put it out here as a, this is my son, golden rule. Don't put dogs or cats over waterfalls.
Just don't do it.
Just don't do it. There's no good reason to. I know you want your movie to have authenticity, but we're in the modern age now. And you can use CGI.
Or you could just put, like, a puppet in a box and push it over.
It's just a stuffed animal. It doesn't need to be a real dog.
It's like, oh, we want our movie to be really realistic. So, like, bye-bye, Muffy. Like,
oh, there goes. There goes another one. Need a better take.
I mean, it's a good thing that we had this litter of 12 kittens uh-huh. that all look the same because we're going to need them.
Yep. Don't do it. That's a no-no. It's
just
a,
don't.
This is my son. No-no. No killing of animals. All right. So we've established that.
Good. Good.
But I wonder, so when going back to how you got into this genre, the sad dog movie genre, what do you say is the formative
movie? The formative movie. I mean, really, the formative movie for... Like, I would consider Plague Dogs more in the just, like, upsetting animal movie super genre.
Mm.
Which, the formative movie for me was Watership Down.
Okay. I'll have to say, I have not either read Watership Down or seen the animated version. I've heard a lot about it, but I don't really know that much about it.
It's by the same studio that did Plague Dogs. It was their first movie, I think. Same author of, Richard Adams was the author, same as Plague Dogs, and it's about a group of rabbits, and it's based on, you know, like, it's semi-realistic, not super realistic as far as rabbit behavior, but enough to kind of make it, you know, so you can suspend your disbelief a little bit,
mm-hmm.
but, the main thing about it is that it is just extremely upsetting. Like, there's extreme violence in the movie. Like, nightmare scenes that are really... Just, like, the way that they're rendered are calculated to make a kid have nightmares. And they did for, like, 7 years of my life. yeah, like, my mom bought me Watership Down when I was 3, on video,
like, wow.
And brought it home and was like, here, this is for your birthday. Or maybe I was turning 4. I don't remember, but
very young.
I was very young. And my mom was like, oh yeah, I've heard of this book and this is a movie and it's about rabbits. You love rabbits.
Mm.
And I watched it and was horrified. So I continued to watch it on a regular basis until I was like, I don't know, like 8 or 9.
Mm.
And then I realized that every time I closed my eyes, I saw like rabbits being gored and decided to stop watching it for about 5 years until I was older.
But it's interesting. So that's like an interesting feature, I think, of being young is, mm-hmm. I think there's a certain fascination with things that terrify us or are very morbid,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting.
Morbid was the phrase that my stepdad used to describe the movie, as he would always like walk in on me just sitting there watching it by myself.
Uh-huh.
I'd be like, why do you watch this? Like, it's morbid. It's like, I don't know what that means. I'm like 7. But
yeah, as a kid, the obsession with death.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when you got death and animals.
Yep.
Got two things that kids love.
The two great tastes that taste great together.
Death and animals. You got, Lion King. You got Watership Down. You got Bambi. You got Dumbo. Oh, yeah.
Dumbo doesn't have any death in it.
Wait, Dumbo?
No, Dumbo doesn't have any death
doesn't
in it.
Doesn't his mother die in Dumbo?
No.
She's just imprisoned.
She's imprisoned.
That's pretty bad, too, though.
Yeah, I mean, that's another sad movie that I have forced people to watch with me.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I there's a certain catharsis to watching that kind of movie, but to me it's kind of like just torturing yourself for no reason. Because, I mean, I totally am of the school of belief that, you know, animals can think and feel and, you know, mm-hmm. have personalities and all of that. But I think a lot of this genre is projecting even more human awareness say mortality onto animals than they actually have, which is sort of like, it sort of regresses you to like, you're putting yourself, you're empathizing with like an animal that is fully self-aware but also fully innocent and fully pure, like without malice, but they're forced to endure suffering, which is kind of like a microcosm of life.
Yeah,
it's like human existence.
Pretty much.
So yeah, it's allows you to it's cathartic,
mm-hmm.
but it also is kind of just like, I'm gonna inflict this on myself right now.
Yeah, I have to be in a specific mood to watch Plague Dogs. Like, when I'm in a mood where I feel like watching Plague Dogs, it's not a good sign.
Hmm. Do you feel better after watching it, though?
Oh, yeah. Always.
Huh.
But yeah, it maybe it doesn't make a lot of sense because it is, like, super upsetting, but there is a catharsis to it.
Mm-hmm.
Or just, like, being able to, like just revel in the bad feelings for long enough in kind of a disconnected context so that when I'm done with it, I feel better.
Yeah, I can see that. And definitely, like, yeah, it's sort of the, you know, when you feel sad, you want to listen to sad music and see sad things because it helps you sort of express and externalize how mm-hmm. you feel.
Oh, yeah.
So this, yeah, it's a powerful way to do that, I would say.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there are limits to that, I feel like. Like, I saw Melancholia, the Lars von Trier movie in theaters.
Mm-hmm.
It ruined my week. Like, I felt way worse than usual all week.
Really? I found it depressing, but I don't know if it had a lasting impact. I know that actually my mom, I think, said the exact same thing. Like, she's like, yeah, we saw that movie, and I kept thinking about it for days and days afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate movies that can have that kind of effect on me, because most of them don't. Like, most movies just kind of fade from my perception unless there was something really special about them.
Mm-hmm.
that one stuck with me, and Plague Dogs is one of those that stuck with me.
Yeah, I could see that. Well, I guess it's time to rate. It feels bad rating something like this.
Yeah.
I wonder, maybe, so the rating for this maybe should be something on a scale of the sad dog scale.
Yeah.
So maybe it's how many dead puppies in a box.
Yeah, how many dead puppies in a box did I send you, Kathy?
God, I would call this... because I didn't cry as strongly as some of the other sad dog movies, I'm only going to give it 4 dead puppies in a box out of 5.
Okay.
But it's still, that's pretty sad.
That's pretty sad.
I enjoyed it, though. It was exquisite in its painfulness and beauty.
Yeah, actually, after I saw the movie for the first time, I went seeking out the soundtrack.
Mm.
And I found, on eBay or something, a 45 single of that song. The I Don't Feel No Pain No More song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's must be depressing to when you put it on the old record player.
Oh, I love it. I love it. I actually ripped it to my computer. Like, I am a freak.
You're not a freak. It's understandable.
Thank you, Kathy.
You're welcome. God bless.
God bless. God bless us, everyone.
Welcome back to the show. We've been on a little break, and it is now time to talk about the son that I gave back to Chris in response to Plague Dogs. This son is a movie that I have enjoyed for quite a while since I saw it. It ignited a pretty significant crush on Gael Garcia Bernal for me.
Which I don't blame you for at all.
I don't think any human can.
I mean, he's very handsome.
He's just a beautiful boy. He's just a small, beautiful Mexican boy.
Yeah, it's... Yeah, I definitely... I can see that. I can see your feelings on that matter.
It is The Science of Sleep, which is a Michel Gondry movie. That's right? That's French.
Yes.
That's how French people say it?
Yes. Michel.
Michel. That is about a young man whose father dies and moves from Mexico to France to live with his mother, and gets a job making or doing typesetting for like calendars, and falls in love with his neighbor, etc., etc. But the premise being that he is sort of like lives sort of halfway between the dream world and reality. Like, he's obsessed with dreaming.
And from the movie, I felt like he was, like, straight up delusional.
Sometimes, yeah. It's, like, it's hard to say during certain parts.
Like, there were some parts where it is just, like, some of it's a mixture between what's really happening and his fantasy, and it's impossible to tell how much is really real.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I felt like maybe the second half of the movie was entirely not real.
Yeah, because it's, like, the first half especially, there are these pretty clear signifiers when you're moving from the dream to reality. Because, like, in the dreams, this, like, the sound isn't synced up with people talking. Like, you're in sort of a fantasy, sort of, like, all the buildings are made out of paper, and there's definitely a surreality to it. And then later, it's not as clear where those transitions happen.
Mm-hmm.
I think you've seen this before, right?
I saw it when it came out. I saw it in theaters, and... thought it was very beautiful and just kind of generally liked it, but then forgot about it for several years. Like, I had forgotten that it was a movie until you mentioned it. And I was like, oh yeah, I should probably watch that again.
Mm. So on this second rewatching, what did you think about it?
I don't know. I had kind of mixed feelings. It's still very beautiful, like the animation and effects, like it's a Gondry movie. So of course, like it's extremely cool to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And like the dream sequences were all amazing. And of course the leading man was very handsome, but he was also, you know, his character was a like lunatic, like a completely unbearable human being who, if I knew him in real life, despite his handsomeness, I would start locking my windows.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely one of the things about it. Well, I find it sort of endearing. Not that, you know, I find his character as being someone I would probably want to spend very much time around, but it's like an authentic depiction of someone who's just like kind of just not a super likable movie character. I mean, he's kind of an asshole.
Oh, no, he's completely an asshole.
Well, he's completely self-centered, right? He lives almost completely inside his own head.
He's completely self-centered, and he's like an enormous dick to his neighbor. Like, anytime he feels even the littlest bit slighted by her.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but I think that compared to, say, I don't know, I'm trying to give another counterexample, it's made pretty clear in the filmmaking that we're not, you know, we kind of identify him, but we're not really that sympathetic to his sort of moodiness and like total irrational behavior. Like, there's one segment where his neighbor finally caves and asks him out on a date, and he's super excited, but then he basically, within his head, decides that she was trying to trick him all along and that she didn't even show up and that she's at home. Yeah. And, like, the power of his own believing that, he manages to, like, you know, mess everything up. He doesn't even go, and then, you know, actually literally runs at the door and, like,
smashes his head
open.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're kind of, like, you're frustrated with him. You kind of, I mean, you sympathize with him because he's also, you know, slightly a genius, but you also kind of hate him.
Yeah, I mean, he's slightly a genius, but he's, like, he's also just clearly a depiction of someone who's straight up delusional. Like, he's, like, mentally ill.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that is upsetting to the people around him. And yeah, it's like the kind of stuff that he says to her, I don't know, like, it's definitely, the way it's portrayed is not, like, it's not sympathetic. Like, we do see things somewhat from her point of view when he's being particularly insufferable, but she, like, instantly forgives him, so.
Yeah, that's the kind of strange thing. I agree with that. Like, if I were her, I would just totally be avoiding him by, like, halfway through the movie.
I would have moved out of the building. I mean, I know it's hard to find a good place to live in Paris, but
yeah,
I probably would have moved out if there was, like, a stalker next door.
You can kind of see, though, that I think to an extent, because from a creative perspective, I mean, so they're both, you know, artsy, basically, mm-hmm. you're crafts-oriented. And you can see there is some amount of, like, they have similar, you know, interests and temperaments. I think ultimately she's right in that she basically is, you know, does not give in to him and doesn't ever actually really start a relationship with him.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I could see from her perspective why it would be fun, especially, you know, since he's sort of manic-depressive, when he's in a manic state, that he would be entertaining to be around.
Yeah, but maybe not entertaining to live next door to.
Yeah, especially since he breaks into her apartment at
least once. I mean, like, he breaks into her apartment to do something that you might take as, like, a cute gesture. But, yeah, it's like her walking in while he's doing it is, like, the reveal to the audience that, yeah, wait, this is actually horrible. Like,
yeah,
this is actually awful. And, like, as she's walking in and turns on the light, and he just kind of, like, jumps into the fetal position, like, on her bed, like,
curls up under her bed. Yeah, that's
like,
not
pretend you
at all.
Didn't see me. I forgot my keys. Goes back out the window.
Uh huh. Yeah. So it's almost like, I don't know. It's, I think at this point in the world of movie criticism, it's almost too cliche to discuss the concept of the manic pixie dream girl or the male equivalent of it, whatever it may be. But he's kind of both a male manic pixie dream girl and also the revelation of how in reality that would be like not a good thing.
Yeah.
Oh, because he's like wacky, he's totally in his own head, he lives in a dream world, he's but also, you know, super creative, and he's, you know, interesting and wacky and zany, but also like mentally unstable and potentially a stalker.
I mean, he's straight up a stalker, like he is like keeping an eye on her like when she's home, and he knows when she's not home, and like, I don't know, he's super jealous later in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's, but it's also pretty clearly shown, like, it's a result of him being massively insecure.
Yeah, and also just being, like, messed up in general.
Yeah. I don't know, I can kind of see, I definitely see the appeal, the potential appeal that someone like that would hold, but also, like, how messed up it would be.
I mean, I could see dating someone like that if you've had like maybe one boyfriend before who is really uptight and he seems like, oh, this guy seems like cool and fun, like interesting, and then you spend like an hour or two with him and you notice that he's breaking into your apartment to like mangle your stuffed toys. And you're like, I don't think this is working out. Also, I'm moving out of the country.
Well, he moved out of the country.
He moved out of the country. Well, we don't know that he did.
Well, yeah, it's definitely another ambiguous ending there, because it switches back to basically his dream state at the end.
Oh, like, and I wondered if that whole sequence wasn't a fantasy that, like...
Because she was very forgiving of him.
She was very forgiving in a way that didn't seem realistic after the stuff that, like, he was saying to her.
Yeah. I don't know, I always interpreted that last scene as probably being real. But I guess you know, thinking about it, it could potentially have been a fantasy also.
Yeah.
The one I always have trouble with is whether or not his calendar idea, which is this calendar he made of famous disasters, there's a sequence of him like, oh yeah, the company he works for actually made the calendar, and he's, you know, the star, and there's a party in his honor. Like, I've never been sure whether that was real or not.
See, that's the place where I felt that it might have been, like, fantasy from then on, because... I don't see that as, like, likely based on anything that happened previously in the movie.
Yeah, because, like, pretty much based on the universe. He introduced the calendar to the head of the company he works for, and it was basically, like, laughed out of the office. So it's very strange that all of a sudden they'd be like, yeah, we're going to make it, and it's successful.
And there was a cut there that was, like, 2 months later, and based on what was going on before, like, he was never showing up to work, like, his co-workers were always covering for him. Like, would he even still be working there after 2 months acting like that? Like,
it's a good question.
The entire, I don't know, the entire rest of the movie from that point on, I kind of see
it. So it throws it into question.
Yeah, it throws it into question. How much of that was real and how much of it was just something he made up in his head.
So, like, the theoretical, like, real world reality might have been basically he was working at the company, like, really unsatisfied with his job. He, you know, freaked out his neighbor and she stopped talking to him, and then he decided to move back to Mexico, and that was it.
Yeah, like, pretty much. Pretty much that's my reading of the film.
And then the rest of it was just, like, completely in his head.
The rest he just had, like, a psychotic break.
It's really interesting, though, to have a movie that has that much ambiguity in it.
Because,
I mean, especially, you know, in America, we don't tend to do stuff like that. And this is, I think this was a French and something else co-production.
Yeah, I
look it up now.
Like, all the titles were in French, so I'm assuming that it was predominantly French, though so much of it was in English that I'm honestly not sure, like, if it was, like, a co-production with, I don't know, the UK or... Like, I wouldn't think US necessarily, but maybe.
Yeah, so the countries listed are France and Italy. Huh. Maybe that's... So, Partisan Films, Gaumont, and France 3 Cinema were the production companies.
Hmm.
And Canal.
And Canal, yeah.
So, there was a, it was a multinational, like a lot of great European movies are. It's a bunch of government incentive programs from a lot of different countries all pitching in.
Yeah.
Because then they can, together, make enough money, contribute enough money to make a single film.
To make a single film, yeah. Well, like, especially, I'm sure this was excruciatingly expensive, like...
Yeah, with all the stop motion.
With all the animation. And
yeah.
They had to make a big costume for that real horse.
They had to make that big velvet outfit for a horse to wear.
Yeah, so how do they do that? How do you tailor an outfit for a horse? You have to hire a special guy. Like,
there's only so many tailors willing to work in horse clothing.
I mean, you have to hire a special horse tailor.
The horse tailor.
You know,
there's only like two in the world.
Yeah, and one of them's like 95.
And there's no one he's going to pass that skill on to.
No, he doesn't have an apprentice. Like, we're running out of horse tailors.
And 20 years from now, there will be no more horse tailors in the world. It'll be a lost art, and we'll never rediscover it.
And there'll be so many nude horses.
Every horse will be running around, buck naked, unclothed.
Yep.
Yeah, probably. So let's say, and now I kind of want to look up its budget. So, you know, say it had a, okay, so it had a $6 million budget. $5 million was horse tailoring.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And then $1 million was, like, everything else.
The rest was, like, you know, rent an apartment building in Paris for, like, one day, and they quickly shot the rest of the movie.
Got everything. Really, there's, like, two locations. There's the office and the apartment building, and then some outdoor stuff, but they probably mm-hmm. could do that for free. They just do it real fast.
And, it's, like, I don't know where they did the outdoor stuff. Maybe that was in Italy? Or just in the countryside somewhere. But the
some of it might be. I was talking about the Paris outdoor scenes.
Oh, too. The Paris outdoor scenes, yeah. Like, it's, if you go to Paris, like, you periodically just come across streets that are shut down. Like, they just, you know, make movies there. I don't know.
Uh-huh. Well, it's like New York.
It's like New York, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and then the other, then $500,000 of that last million was spent on that White Stripes song that was in it.
Yeah. Yeah, I found it interesting that they actually used Instinct Blues, but they used it with vocals in it,
mm-hmm.
which I feel is kind of rare in the context that they used it. As like, they used it as a score piece, but they left the vocals in.
Yeah, I don't know. I wonder what the logic behind that is. I think I read one other place that they, you know, it's in the movie, but it didn't make it onto the soundtrack, so maybe they didn't get the right licensing.
Yeah, maybe.
To have it for that? I'm not sure.
Like, maybe they... Like, he did that music video for the White Stripes, so he may have just asked them, like, hey, can I use this song in my movie? And they were like, yeah, sure.
Sure, just take it off the soundtrack.
Just don't put it on the soundtrack. Don't sell it on record, but you could put it in your movie.
You can totally put it in the score of your movie. It's fine. Huh. No, so now I'm reading all of the, like, trivia facts about it.
Okay, what are the...
Well, there are no chroma keys in the movie, except for the ones that are in Stefan TV.
Huh.
Another, everything else was not. So I guess the things where he's sort of, like, standing in the office and there's, the paper buildings behind them were actual...
Oh, wow.
Oh, no, it was done before shooting with a step-by-step method.
Huh.
Huh, that was interesting. So they did, like, actual film shit with this, basically, is what it's...
That's awesome.
Yeah, and it's pretty... rare these days to be like, let's do in-camera special effects.
Yeah. When was this made?
Was it like 2006?
Oh, 06.
06.
Huh. Yeah, I mean, I guess, like, yeah, everyone was still using 35mm to shoot at that point, so it was probably easier to do in-camera than it would be now.
I don't know. I think still, right, even when you're shooting in film, people are more likely to want to do computer special effects. You know, chroma keying is a lot easier than being like, hey, we're going to shoot a mask and then we're going to shoot the characters and, like, I don't know. It's, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But I assume that was made to help enhance the dreamlike effect.
Yeah, it did look extremely good. Like, everything in this movie looked extremely good.
Mm-hmm. And to me, like, that, I feel like a lot of movies that have dream sequences, to me, they don't really reflect what it actually feels like to be in a dream.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of people do dream sequences that are just like, oh, we'll have stuff that's kind of blurry and vague and, like, there's, like, weird, you know, special visual effects on it.
Mm-hmm.
But, I don't know, to me, when I dream, it's a lot more like there's a very sharp clarity on really specific things.
Yeah.
And then everything else kind of falls away, which to me, this was a better representation of.
Yeah, and I felt like it represented the mindset of dreams really well.
Hmm.
Where, yeah, it is, it feels real, but, like, nothing makes sense, or people are acting strangely, or it blends in with, you know, your real life, like.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it takes the elements from your real life, and it also has, you know, like, stuff that doesn't, it's not directly from anywhere, it doesn't really make sense why it's happening, so, like, mm-hmm. there's, you know, sequence where he, like, he bends over a rock, and it compresses his stomach.
Yeah.
As he reaches for her. I'm like, yeah, that sort of seems like a dream, right? Where it's just, like, something where'd that come from? It's really not clear.
It's just, like, you have a phrase or an emotion or an idea about what is happening in the dream or why. Like, yeah, like, leaning on a rock and saying, it's compressing my stomach. That's unbelievably strange, but it is totally, like, something that would come into your mind is like, oh yeah, it's because it compressed my stomach that I'm attributing causal effects to that.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But I liked it. But I did, yeah, I did find, like, her, endless forgiveness of our protagonist very frustrating.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, I think though too, I mean, I sort of understood it because I think she, you know, really did actually like him despite herself, because I think she sort of rationally knew, like, yeah, this is not a good relationship to be in, because you can kind of tell she's pretty much constantly kind of either disdainful or annoyed mm-hmm. by him. But I think she's still sort of drawn to him regardless,
or she at least I don't know that she's disdainful necessarily, but she does she has a grip on reality and he doesn't. I'd like to pose the theory that he is the snitter of this film.
Essentially that's a good tie-in, right? Both people who have problems grasping the difference between the subjective and objective realities.
And they both habitually hurt people who try to help them.
Yeah, he accidentally shot a man in the face. I mean, Stefan, from Signs of Sin.
Stefan found his true master and accidentally shot him in the face.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so there's the tie-in. I did it.
Good.
I picked a suitably connected movie to your son.
Great job.
Yes. It's always important to find the tie-in.
Good, good.
So
is it time to rate?
Yeah, you ready to rate?
Yeah, I'm trying to decide what the scale is that I want to rate on. Because, you know, I'd give it, like, 5 out of 5 beautiful stop-motion landscapes.
Mm.
But maybe only 3 out of 5 of, you know, paranoid, insane delusions.
Well, so you can have as many ratings as you want. I think we should not be bound to having one scale that covers the entire movie when there are components of it that you'd like to rate separately.
Okay. Well, then those are my ratings.
Okay. So we got the stop-motion landscapes is basically the max.
Yeah, that's the best you can do.
best you can do in terms of stop motion landscapes, in terms of paranoid, delusional characters that we probably wouldn't like in real life.
I mean,
3 out of 5.
That, I mean, I guess it's like, are we rating how much we would dislike them in real life?
However you want it to be. The rating can be however you want.
I'm going to give him, yeah, I'm going to give him 3 out of 5. And okay. I will leave that ambiguous.
All right. I think we understand from our discussion.
Yes. And I emotions. Would give him 4 out of 5 handsome, troubled boys.
Handsome, troubled boy. I agree. Yeah, I mean, I basically have the same feelings, especially watching. I think I've seen it maybe 3 or 4 times now. And I probably was a lot more sympathetic to Stefan as a character the first time, and then it's, mm-hmm. I think it's been degrading the more times I've watched it.
I think maybe that comes with growing up a little and
that could be
seeing,
it too, yeah.
Yeah, like, I liked him a lot more the first time. And then
but it was 10 years ago, so.
Yeah.
And we are now 45 years old, both of us.
We're now 150 years old.
Uh-huh.
Thank God we're finally 300 years old, Kathy.
We're finally mature enough at 450 years old to be able to appreciate this movie, you know, in an objective way.
Yes.
Well, you know, God bless, and, you know, great to hear that. Are there any things that you would like to plug today? I've decided I'm going to institute plugs at the end of the show.
Oh, we're gonna start doing plugs?
Yeah, we're going to plug it.
Okay, we're going to plug it. We're going to plug it up.
Yep.
Plug up that podcast. Well, I have a podcast that I haven't worked on in a while that's about Star Trek. It's called Starfleet Academy Truants, and we are going to continue doing episodes even though we haven't done any for a while. So, academytruants.tumblr.com.
Coming back soon,
and you can follow me on Twitter at Krishva, that's K-R-I-S-H-V-A. Like, I have a website and stuff, but that's not really important. I don't think anyone wants that, so...
Yeah, well, they can use Google and then the tools of online to locate it.
They can go to google.biz.
They can, if you access www.google.biz, that will lead you directly to Chris's website.
Yes. I love to mislead our listeners.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah, we only have, like, people who know at this point. I don't know anyone that is not aware that is listening to this podcast of the realities of Google.biz, so.
It's still my favorite net site, Kathy.
Get online.
I'm getting online.
I would like to promote this podcast, which is ongoing. You're listening to it right now, so I assume you already know what's going on. As well as, hey, if you want to go historical, Brian Weekly was the thing that I did. It's not happening anymore, but it used to.
Didn't Max never posted the ending, did he?
No, I keep telling him to, and he doesn't do it.
Like, he was saying that, like, he was like, oh, well, let's get input from the team, and then we never set up any time to provide input.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on in his brain. I'll ask him the next time he's on the podcast.
Okay, well, let's do it publicly so we can hold him accountable.
Okay, this is a formal, we're calling Max out for not posting the last episode of Brian. It exists, but it is not online.
Just, like, yeah, Max, just post it.
Just,
like,
put it, just upload it.
We've all disconnected from Brian. We're offline.
We're offline.
Just post it.
Put it up. Just have it up so it can be concluded.
All right.
Okay. You can access me on Twitter at MySocks, MySOKS, or you can follow this podcast at This Is My Son, and that will give you all the updates for the future.
Is it on iTunes?
It's on iTunes. You get on iTunes, you search for This Is My Son, and it's somehow between all of the parenting podcasts. It's there.
Amidst the parenting podcast is a misleadingly titled podcast about our media sons.
Uh-huh. Nobody knows where it is or why it's there, but it is. It is online on iTunes.
All right.
Thanks for joining me today, Chris.
Thank you for having me, Kathy.
I'm happy to have you, and I hope you'll be back in the future.
I have many sons that I would like to share with you.
I'm excited to experience them. So until next time, folks, have a nice week.
Bye.
Bye.